Have you called the case? Okay. Mr. Cox? Yeah, Mr. Cox?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Peter Koch and I represent the petitioner, Spectrum Health. This case, as you well know, is controlled by Shaw Supermarkets. First time, the NLRB decided that an employer may withdraw recognition from an incumbent union during the term of a collective bargaining agreement. Two requirements are necessary. First, the employer must have objective evidence of an uncoerced loss of majority support, which is not at issue here. Second, the withdrawal has to come after the three-year contract bar period has expired. The underlying rationale for this rule is that employees' statutory rights are compelling interests, which cannot be barred by an agreement that is beyond the third year of the term. The only issue before this court, as stipulated by the parties and as recognized by the board, is the term of the parties' collective bargaining agreement. If the term of the agreement began on January 1, 2005, as clearly stated on the face of the agreement, then the general counsel has conceded that Spectrum Health acted lawfully. Notably, the general counsel carries the burden of proof. He must prove that the parties' agreement had a term of 3 years or less.
You say clearly stated on the face of the agreement. When you read an agreement, I normally start with where it says this is an agreement. This is an agreement by and between the parties effective April 13, 2005.
Well, I've been practicing labor law for 40 years, doing almost nothing but bargaining. The first page is the most important page. Whether it's a union official, a steward, a vice president of human resources, the first thing you do when you grab for that drawer for the contract is you look at the cover.
Then what is the first paragraph mean then?
First paragraph simply indicates when the agreement became an agreement.
When it became effective.
When it became effective, actually. Absolutely right.
So the terms of the agreement didn't take effect until April 13, 2005.
Nothing in the contract took effect until April 13. And one of the things to aid your review of this is the effective date can precede or follow the term of an agreement. In fact, there are very few collective bargaining agreements where the effective date, the ratification date, matches up squarely with the term. In this case, for example, as is normally the case, the parties reach an agreement toward the end of an existing agreement. Say they had a contract ratified in December of 2004 in this case, the contract would read January 1, 2005.
In Section 69, when you're talking about the wage provisions, it uses the phrase the first year of the contract and then the beginning of the second and third contract years. What years are those?
Well, there's two actually wage adjustments.
Right.
There's one that goes retroactive.
Right, for folks
who are already up. And then it will proceed for three more years from that point. And then on the new hires, that starts April 13 and rolls out three more years. What happened here,
I'm referring to the phrasing that's used in the agreement uses the phrase the first year of the contract and then the second and third contract years. What's meant by the first year of the contract?
Well, they are in.
It says during the first year of the contract, such employees will receive retroactive to January 1, 2005. That seems to be distinguishing between the first year of the contract and the time period retroactive to January 1, 2005.
Well, they're at a period when they're looking back and looking forward at the same time. I mean, they're looking back retroactively and they're looking forward, but they are in the first year of the contract.
So give me the dates.
The term of the contract.
The phrase is
Benjamin
Franklin. First year of the contract. What are the dates of the first year of the contract? The first year of the contract begins on?
The effective term of the agreement.
What's the
first year of that agreement begins on January 1.
Counsel, that's not the question I asked. The phrase is the first year of the contract. Give me the beginning date of the first year of the contract. And then give me the ending date of the first year of the contract, as it's set forth in Section 69.
Right. The first year of the contract became alive on April 13. And that's the first year of the contract, as the parties saw it at that time.
Okay.
The statement on the cover
does that mean that for incumbent employees, The beginning of the second year was again April 13th of the next year. Is that when they received their lump sum payment or combination of the general wage increase?
Yes. The statement on the cover is clear and unambiguous. The word through is the only thing that one would even have to consult a dictionary about. It means, as Webster says, from the beginning to the end of. From January 1, 2005 to the end of the contract, March 31. Statement of intent here was intentional. It was negotiated. It changed throughout the process. The statement is consistent with the agreement's other provisions. There are provisions that talk about retroactive effect, and there are provisions which specifically attempt to prevent retroactive effect because the contract is, in fact, retroactive. The statement of intent is consistent with board precedent. The case that is on all fours with this is Benjamin Franklin, where the NLRB said it's the effective term of the agreement, the effective term. The date on the inside indicates when the contract was ratified, when it became a contract. The terms of that contract, whether it's wages or health benefits or retiree benefits or the term, are a function of the contract created by the parties. And the board's responsibility is to give effect to that intent. That hasn't been done here. Instead, the general counsel, the administrative law judge, and the board have offered numerous different and inconsistent theories for why this language should not be given its obvious effect. Party's statement of term has been dismissed as quote-unquote just language, which of course is what contracts are made of, ignored as a glitch, this declared by the administrative law judge on no evidence to be a mistake, and creatively parsed and minimized as a reflection of certain retroactive terms. The board's final position in the decision on appeal is to throw up its hands and state that the record is insufficient to ascribe any meaning to this language at all. In the board's words, quote, we can assign no meaning to the term, nor attentions to the parties, where the evidence provides none. This is fatal. Under the cardinal principle of contract interpretation that you must give effect to all elements, it is fatal under the board's own precedent, Des Moines Register, which requires the general counsel to prove the terms of the agreement. These words on the face are the only place.
I guess I'm following that part. All Des Moines says is that you have to prove the terms of the agreement. And here they prove the terms of the agreement by finding the thing that you said ambiguous and looking at parole evidence to resolve the matter along with everything else.
Well, they only did that after completely ripping off the first page of the agreement. Well,
that's not has nothing to do with Des Moines. Des Moines is just about the obligation to prove the meaning of the contract. It's
not in this case, you can't prove the unfair labor practice, which they have the burden of proof for. Yeah. Until and unless you prove this is a contract of less than 3 years' duration.
Correct, but that doesn't mean that you have to be able to get that out of the cover of the document. The board's position was, at the board, that it was ambiguous between the different provisions, and so they looked at parole evidence, and they concluded that there was a term, and the term was...
Yeah, and they looked at parole evidence, and this is the parole evidence that they looked at. Noting the party's tentative agreement that the collective bargaining agreement will expire on November 2, 2007, Joe Martin asked, he's the spokesperson for Spectrum Health, Joe Martin asked whether the party should consider instead entering into a three-year agreement which would expire 3 years after ratification slash approval by the union. The parties will consider the possibility, but absent agreement to the contrary, the contract will expire as previously agreed, November 2, 2007. Amazingly, when the board referenced this, they treated this as proof of an agreement. This was discussed as a possibility, and even in the board's own statement, they indicate this, the preponderance of evidence, including the bargaining notes and so on and so forth, show that the parties agreed to a three-year contract which would expire 3 years after final approval and ratification by the union. That period ran from April 13, 2005, when the contract was ratified, until April 1, 2008, the termination date in the contract. That's not even 3 years. This wasn't an agreement. This was, why don't we consider? And if we don't consider, we're back to where we started. No, this was a situation where when they finally got to agreement, they took the original proposal, which was January to November, and they decided to extend it to March. And when they did that, they created the term of the agreement. It's spelled out on the first page. They negotiated. The first page changed. When you went to the first page in the final agreement, they left January 1 where it was. Well, they changed the date to its immediate right to March 31, not April 13. There's no April 13, 2005 on the face. There's no April 13 on the end. This was negotiated. There's no magic in it. The parties, according to Ben Franklin, have the right to set the term. It could have been 6 months. It could have been 4 years. They set the term. They did. And the IRB can't just rip it out of the contract. And with that, Your Honor, I'll reserve any remaining time for rebuttal.
Mr. Cohen.
May it please the court, my name is Richard Cohen. I'm appearing on behalf of the National Labor Relations Board. If you look at the body of this agreement, and it says in the body of this agreement, right at the top, agreement, and it says right under that, as Judge Griffith pointed out, in clear and explicit terms, that the agreement, this is an agreement between the parties. This agreement between the parties is effective April 13th. If you look at this agreement, it's the body of the agreement. There is not a single bit of ambiguity that this agreement had an effective date. It began.
What are we to make of the statement on the cover?
The statement on the cover, there is zero, contrary to what counsel says, zero evidence, extrinsic or otherwise, as to what the import of the dates on the cover are. I should point out that this is not an enforcement of a contract issue. This is an issue of when the presumption, the irrebuttable presumption of majority status attaches. The board has always said it attaches as of the effective date of the agreement. It couldn't attach any other time. And contrary to what counsel says about Ben Franklin, everything in Ben Franklin points exactly to that proposition. The court on the first page said that the execution date of that agreement, which was the only date other than the dates indicated in the agreement, was the execution date is unreliable as to say when the agreement began. People often don't draft agreements until much later. They don't get around to signing them much later. This agreement here doesn't even have a date as to when the agreement was signed. It does specify when it became effective, and it specifies exactly to the minute as to when it terminated. And in the body of the agreement itself, there is nothing, zero, to suggest that the whole agreement is retroactive. The wage provision in that agreement leaves only one conclusion, that January 1 was a retroactive date. Therefore, this contract couldn't exist, and it didn't exist until another date. And everything in the wage provision indicates that the effective date stated in the first paragraph is in fact the effective date. It distinguishes between current employees who get one set of wages from future hires. Future hires from when? from when the contract became born. Now, there is not a scintilla of doubt that before April 13th, back through January 1, there was no contract bar that would have prevented employees or an outside union to petition for an election. There was nothing to stop the company from withdrawing recognition if it had evidence. There was no irrebuttable presumption. And an irrebuttable presumption could not be applied retroactively. The board said that both at the very early, when they were confronted with issues of ratification, and when they were confronted with issues as to an agreement that was signed earlier and didn't become effective until later.
Pause for one second. Why doesn't the meaning, instead of meaning nothing, why isn't the purpose of the statement at the bottom of the cover indicating that some things have retroactive effect to January 1st, namely these wages?
That is a possibility. And the judge found, and the board didn't dispute, that the most more likely possibility, based upon everything in the bargaining history, was that January 1 was simply carried over from previous agreements. The drafter of this agreement was the company. And you have to look at the agreement.
I'm not asking about that. I guess what I'm asking is, we know that after the effective date, some wage provisions are going to be retroactive. That is, people will be paid as of January 1st,
right?
So why is it not possible that that's all that this means? The date of agreement covers some things that will occur in January.
That's certainly a possibility. The judge found it was a slight possibility, and he found it for several sophisticated, very compelling reasons. But it doesn't matter. As the board said, this agreement and the bargaining history concerning it couldn't be more clear. It couldn't be more clear what the parties intended.
Could I ask you a couple of questions about the bargaining order? I mean,
yes.
As I understand it, an affirmative bargaining order is extraordinary. Right? I mean, it's not in the norm. Is that right? I mean, we require, therefore, that the board give its explanation for the bargaining order with some degree of specificity, right, applied to this particular circumstance. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. How is that met here? What the board has done here is they've copied verbatim language that's been taken from other orders and applied it here without any discussion of the particular.
As a matter of fact, the board, let me just say, the board did not do that. It had a very specific explication of why the withdrawal of recognition, followed by what were a slew of unfair labor practices.
You're saying the explanation for the affirmative bargaining order here has not been cut and pasted from other decisions?
Absolutely not. But beyond that, we don't get there, Your Honor.
Well, I understand there's serious waiver problems here.
Well, it's not a waiver issue. If I may take a moment, because I think this is really significant, and I think that it needs to be clarified. Section 10E speaks in general terms, and it is jurisdictional.
Right.
The Supreme Court held it. It is jurisdictional. Given that it's general language, the board was entitled to fill in the details of when and how, and it specified when in the clearest of terms. And this court, under Chevron and under Yankee Nuclear and under its decision in Harvard Industries, must accept the board's rule.
Here's something that puzzles me. Maybe you can help me understand it. So the board enters an affirmative bargaining order here, telling Spectrum that you have to negotiate with the union. Yet, even under the board's reading, there were only a few weeks left in the collective bargaining agreement, and they had objective evidence that the union had lost its support. Is that common for the board in these circumstances to issue an affirmative bargaining order?
There were 3 months left, Your Honor, and
for some reason I thought it was 10 weeks, but.
That's pretty close, 2.5 months. I think it was a little more than 10 weeks, but it will take 10 weeks. Those are the periods when negotiations occur, when agreements are reached, and the company could have, as the company in Highland and in Parklawn did, anticipatorily withdraw recognition. The reason why it didn't, it had a few people over a majority sign this petition. It could have also told them to go get an election. But in anticipatory withdrawal, it could have said, we're not going to bargain until we can withdraw. And as Parklawn and Highland show, you lose that majority by the end.
So is your point really that's up to the company to do that? It's not up to what the board had in front of it was
a naked withdrawal that was untimely, and at a time when bargaining would take place. Now I have to point out, if the company had waited, anticipatorily withdrew, which it didn't. Now it says it could have, and the board should have said that it wasn't obligated to bargain from that time. But A, the likelihood is that it would have lost that majority for its petition. And the reason for it is that it demonstrably was giving wage increases substantially to all the other employees. So why wouldn't collective bargaining produce at least that? Could the company have offered less? So the employees would have known, rather than what happened in 2005 when the company unlawfully declared an impasse and cut off bargaining for 3 months.
Okay. Let me ask you one question, Mr. Cohen. This front page also says that it, besides January 1st, 2005, that it goes through March 31st, 2008, and the end of the contract also gives the termination date as 12:01 a.m., April 1st. Is it your position that the company could have withdrawn recognition on April 1st, notwithstanding 3 years had not elapsed, if April 13th is the beginning date?
Yes.
Okay.
If they had, at that time, proof at that time that a majority of the employees no longer wanted the union, and
so the position is that you can contractually contract the 3 year period.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks. All right. Does Mr. Koch have any time left? All right, why don't you take a minute, Mr. Coates?
A couple quick points. We talked about future hirees and the anniversaries. I want to note Joint Appendix 220, where that particular proposal was made. It says this, quote, annual increase dates to be as of anniversaries of contract effective date, not January 1. There's absolutely no reason to put not January 1 in unless the parties presumed and intended a retroactive term.
Maybe it's to make absolutely clear that they didn't. That seems like more likely.
Well, part of the problem here is that every one of these requires us to speculate. That's why we go back to the cover. It sets the term. It's the only place that has both dates, beginning and end. And if you go then to Benjamin Franklin, where the board said...
This is just a factual question. No. So on the cover, it says date of agreement through March 31, 2008. In the body of the agreement, when does it give as the date that it ends? It's actually April, isn't it?
Well, it's April 1.
Oh, is that what it says?
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's not unusual to see that. There's another provision, Your Honor, and that's set forth in Joint Appendix 277, where Section 5, the dues authorization effective date, checkoff of deductions under all properly executed authorization for checkoff of dues shall begin with the month following the execution of this agreement and shall not be retroactive. Again, no point in putting that in the agreement if the parties did not intend a retroactive term. One point on the remedy.
Your position is that everything in the contract is retroactive?
Unless stated otherwise, that's the term.
So then why does the wage term say it's retroactive?
I think, is exactly what you said. One of the key elements when you get beyond a contract that's expired, the union is focused on making sure whatever raise they get is retroactive. It's a selling point. It's a big selling point at the ratification meeting. So they want it nailed down. They don't want to stand up there and say, oh, it's a retroactive contract, so don't worry about that. And so they ensure by putting it in, arguably redundantly. On the remedy, a couple points here. This obviously is an extreme remedy. There were no unfair labor practices prior to the union putting the petition on the table. The employer...
I've got two problems with your argument about the remedy. First of all, in your exception to the ALJ's order, you used very broad language that, at least in one case, in Quasite, we rejected as saying it was too general.
Yes, and in W&M Properties, this court said a way to remedy the generalized exception is to file a motion for reconsideration.
Yeah, but in Parkwood, we said that's too late. And you didn't say anything about Parkwood.
Well, and
Parkwood says a motion for reconsideration is too late. You got to do it at the first possible moment. You
right.
Can't wait till later.
We're talking.
So the time for you to do this, to make an objection to the affirmative bargaining order under Parkwood, was when you filed your exceptions to the ALJ. And what I'm telling you is, as I look at your objection there, it's just a generalized objection to the affirmative bargaining order, and that. We've rejected that in Quasi. We said that language just doesn't get it. You have to be more specific than just this generalized objection.
Well, keep in mind here, if we're talking waiver, I mean, that's a two-way street. When we requested a motion for reconsideration, shouldn't the general counsel have objected? Shouldn't the NLRB have objected? They considered.
Our case law says 10E is jurisdictional, so right. We don't have to do that.
But one other point on the remedy is this. The notion that the employer could do as counsel represented is not correct. Once there's been a withdrawal, we don't have a choice. We must withdraw and refuse to bargain. What general counsel said at the opening hearing in this case was, you should have done Parkwood. You should have anticipatorily withdrew, which would entitle you to refuse to bargain with the union about a new contract. And at the end of the day, what's the remedy? Bargain with the minority union. Nobody's looked at how futile that process will be to bargain with somebody who everybody knows does not represent the principal. If the employer did that, came to the table and said, you know, I'm a spokesman for Spectrum, but they haven't given me any authority to bargain. That's an unfair labor practice. Because it makes bargaining ineffectual. So how is this going to work on the other side?
You need to wrap it up.
So consequently, on the remedy, we think, nonetheless, this court has spoken many, many times that the board needs to follow a case-by-case analysis, and had they done that, we would not be looking at a bargaining order, and we ask that you not impose it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.